you very much, men. I'm very pleased that Marina agreed to join me in here. I was invited to come and speak or do something in this exhibition by Katia Kameli, and when she invited me, I didn't realize that I was in the exhibition, literally. Some of you have seen the exhibition, saw the video there, and the little interview on translation that she and I had done at a moment when we didn't know each other, and we did it over Skype, we had never met. Anyway, she was in the preliminary stages of her research on this, the project that's exhibited in this room, Stream of Stories. She had already made The Storyteller, which is in the next room, and she'd made it in Marrakesh, in Morocco, where I am from. And I had no idea she was going to include that Skype conversation in an exhibition, but there it was. So in thinking about this notion of the stream of stories, of the travels of stories, the metamorphoses of stories, and of doing something around those issues in London, I could not think of Marina and her work on stories and storytelling and metamorphoses. And it turned out that Marina was working on a project that just took place in May and in September, in two parts, one part in Oxford, the other part in Sicily, in Palermo, just a few weeks ago. That has to do with what Mend was saying, storytelling in circumstances of exile and on the imaginative power or the possible imaginative shelter that stories can provide in people who are refugees or in situations of exile. Marina will tell us about that project and what happened in Sicily and the ideas that she was working with, and that then how they got tested and transformed on the ground and with the participation of many other people. But I know you wanted to discuss a little bit the exhibition itself, perhaps before we get to that.
Yes.
Maybe has everybody seen the various pieces of the exhibition or not? Everybody has. No, not everybody. Okay.
Actually, you first told me about The Storyteller, and that's how I first heard about Katia Kameli's work.
Yes, before the exhibition.
Quite a long time ago.
Yeah.
And I looked it up online and saw it there.
I could try and sum it up. The Storyteller is the video in the next room. It's a 12-minute video that she made. It was a commission for the Marrakesh Biennial in 2012. And I think she was probably already thinking about the idea of stories and storytelling. So she went to Marrakesh looking for traditional storytellers. That is to say, many of you might know, in Marrakesh there's the Place Jan Alfna, which is a huge public square, which is kind of the throbbing heart of the city and has been for a long time. And you find all sorts of storytellers and
snake charmers.
I mean, there's different sorts of people doing performance type things that could have to do with dance or storytelling or work with animals or acrobats, etc. Or herbal medicine, healing, or soothsayers, etc. And there is one particular tradition, which is the halqa, the circle of storytelling, and you would have somebody and people surrounding them, and they would be telling traditional stories. The thing is, that is an art in the process of disappearing. There are a few old storytellers left, maybe five main old storytellers left, and they haven't really passed on the art to their children. They're all in their 70s or 80s, but there is nobody in their 40s or 50s still there doing it. Now, in the last 3 or 4 years, there's a group of young people, they're in their 20s, and they've learned from some of those old guys. We don't know yet what they're going to do with that, but I should say perhaps that interestingly, this generation of young students who've decided to learn from one of the old storytellers, they're telling the stories in Arabic and in English, which is a very new thing. They realize that to make it live, they need to be able to tell the stories to other people than Moroccans themselves. But we can discuss that later. In any case, so she met with one of the old storytellers, the person in the video who's well known in Marrakesh. And when you watch her video, you see him telling the story, and then there's a parallel montage, and it's edited with scenes from the film. And then as you watch the video, you realize that the story he's telling, which is supposed to be a traditional Moroccan story, is in fact, he's retelling the story of a Bollywood film. verbatim, I mean, he's really just literally, linearly telling the story of the Bollywood film. But he's not saying it's a Bollywood film. He's not saying the boy and the mother are in India. He's just telling it as the story he's telling in Morocco. So it you know, poses all sorts of questions about what is a traditional story, you know, where does it come from, how does it get translated, how does it get told. The other part of it is where it is filmed. It is filmed in the location where it was exhibited during the biennial, which is a kind of an iconic building in Marrakesh. It's the Théâtre Royal, the Royal Theatre of Marrakesh, which is an unfinished building and has been an unfinished building for decades. It's finished on the outside. It's a very kind of flashy building on the outside. And it's very raw on the inside. It's this unfinished cement, hollow interior. So where it's filmed is one of the balconies of the theater, overlooking the main room, which is just, it's all just the basic shapes and the cement, unpainted, unfinished, etc. The story of that is that the then king of Morocco visited the Opéra Garnier in Paris and decided he wanted the same and commissioned an architect to do it, and they started building. And then at a certain point, I don't know how that worked out, but they realized that the acoustics would be terrible because some mistake had been made in the calculations. But I think they weren't able to determine whose responsibility that was. There was some trial. No conclusion was reached. They just abandoned it. And it just remained there. So they do, there's been shows happening there, but outside in the courtyard, but nothing inside ever. Until the curators of the Marrakesh Biennial 4 years ago decided it would be a fantastic stage for contemporary art. Art is a very cannibalistic milieu. It can go and live anywhere. That building is a kind of strange, I don't know, maybe it's a ruin in reverse in the Robert Smithson kind of sense, a thing that was never. But in any case, it might have felt to Katya to be a good metaphor for the loss of oral tradition, perhaps, this kind of.
Well, also the bricolage of today.
Or the bricolage of
today's culture, I think works really well.
Yeah. So it was filmed
also,
there, and then
also
it was exhibited.
It's scribbled on. I mean, it's because the cement is raw, and it's been, and you can still see the lines of metal through the raw cement. There is a sense of a project in both in, as you say, sort of half ruined, but also in. With a futurity, which may not happen.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, but that's what Smithson says. The ruins in reverse are, they don't fall into ruin, they rise into ruin.
Exactly,
you know?
Yes.
And also it's an imported kind of building, right? It's like the Bollywood story becoming a Moroccan traditional story. It's this Paris opera. Mm. Becoming this impossible.
But also, but the Bollywood plot itself and the whole story is based on a series of catastrophes and disasters and coincidences, and so it has this. It's the and then suddenly, with fate overriding, kind of directing the disastrous lives of poor humans, and that is the most. I made a mistake thinking about it when I was trying to remember it. I thought it was a Persian romance. Mm-hmm. I had because it ends happily with a sort of family reunited in love with a new female character, so there's a sort of promise of romance as well. I had totally transfigured it in my mind into an old Persian story, but I think it wasn't a complete mistake. Basically, there was a wonderful exhibition at the Metropolitan Museum in New York called Interwoven Globe, Did you see it?
I don't think
it was
so.
About fabrics. It was about the manufacture of fabrics and tapestries. And it showed how so many skills from the actual spinning of the cloth all the way through to the embroidery and then to the stories that are in actually told in these in the tapestries and sometimes even in the sort of coverlets and even brocaded costumes that were worn by 18th century noblemen in England. All these kinds of stories get into these fabrics. Mm-hmm. And it showed that there was, along the trade routes in particular, there was a constant flow of motifs, imaginative motifs. And that's very similar to what she shows, because we're really, the storyteller is telling a story that has come from India, but it went to India originally from somewhere, then it's travelled back into its... So this is called the stream of stories, this room, and it is the stream of stories.
Yeah. And the project in this room is stems from... So Katia Kameli is a French-Algerian artist, and so she went to school in France. And in France, one of the things that you learn in school by heart, in part, is the Fable de La Fontaine, the Fables of La Fontaine. And she was telling me when we did the Skype interview that she one day realized, when she started looking into stories, the paradigmatic kind of story or fable or collection that she knew from childhood was Les Fables de La Fontaine. She started doing research on it and realized that La Fontaine had taken a number of the tales from Kalila Wadimna, which is a 8th century Arab collection of animal stories that was translated from Persian, and then that Kalila Wadimna came from a set of the Pachatantra, a set of 3rd century Sanskrit stories. So she's decided to trace the voyages and the transformations of certain motifs in the stories from one collection to another.
But I think this genealogy is completely fascinating, but at the same time it doesn't actually map the genealogy geographically, which in a way her work does. Mm-hmm. So it would be, one could match this particular family tree of the travelling stories onto the map, it would actually give you an even richer sense of how these cross-cultural conversations. But in the interview you talk in geographical terms. You say that translation is a border or a frontier, and one of the things you say about it is that it's like the edge of a forest. It's the part, the translation is the part of the territory that is changing from one thing to another. So when you say, you use the French word lisière, which we don't really have such a pretty word in English, but it is the edge, you call it the outskirts. But it's that point, and it's absolutely a fairy tale area, because that's often where...
It's not a line, it's a sort of territory.
And it's where the sort of hut of the person, the wise person, or even the witch, sometimes it's deeper in the forest, but it's often the person telling the story is kind of on that edge. So they're facing both ways. They're facing towards the castle, the urban setting, and they're facing into the depths of the forest where the initiation, where the exploration will take place. Mm-hmm. So that's the kind of, that doubled space.
Right. A kind of territory where translation takes place that doesn't belong to one language or the other, that is a carved territory that's carved out of the border between them.
And it's, you said it's a sort of no man's land. And the no man's land is a very complex phrase, and I don't fully understand it. I've been trying to do some work on it. But it seems to me that one of the things that's happened in the world is that we're actually creating these spaces in the form of the refugee camp. We're creating many, many no man's lands, which are edge places, edge lands. They don't belong anywhere. They've been excluded from somewhere. They're under jurisdictions that are outside of them. Sometimes the UN, sometimes some other regime. So these places filled with people who have fled in order to survive, they have to make a bridge somewhere that will actually you know, speak to them, acknowledge their dignity, and so forth. So these are absolutely translation zones, where translation is the most imperative activity. Not simply linguistic translation, and that's one of the things, but cultural translation, understanding each other through, you know, and that's in a way one of the ideas behind this idea is, can you carry your shelter with you by carrying your culture with you, by actually expressing yourself in such a way that people pay attention.
Well, perhaps this is a good moment to talk about your project and workshop and conference.
It was really that. We're all, I think, feeling very helpless, and I'm not in terms of the kind of crisis that's sweeping the world, and I don't at all think that this is in any way going to really achieve very much. But it just is a sort of attempt to think about it in a slightly different way. How do you arrive at a kind of human existence through when you have nothing? Because one thing you do have is you have words. So even if you haven't got water to drink, you actually still have words. So how to sort of mobilize that? I mean, you may not last very long if you've got no water to drink to say anything, but it seems that it's a resource that in a sense is actually being denied to the refugee. And one of the ways that the refugee is denied that, it seems to me, is that they are required, as you all know, to tell a story. In order to seek asylum, you need to tell a story, and then you must stick to that story.
Your story.
Yeah, it's your story. So there's an absolute demand for subjective confession. And I think that the model for this kind of storytelling is absolutely not what Katya has done in The Storyteller. It's a million miles from that. And it's related in terms of literary history to a kind of tale that was called a pardon tale, which was the tale that imprisoned people in 16th and 17th century France. They were able to tell the story to the magistrates, which would be passed on to the king. And if the king was moved by the story, a pardon would be granted. And this was a whole mode of narrative, a mode of subjective narrative called the pardon tale. And in some cases, it was successful. It's exactly like asylum seeking. In some cases, it's successful. The imperative for the writer of this tale, or the speaker of this tale in the 16th century, was truthfulness. But actually, what was effective with the king was absolutely not truthfulness. What was effective with the king was some show of sincerity, of pain, suffering, justification. So, and it's very similar. The next instantiation, it seems to me, for this kind of storytelling is the slave narrative, which was extremely successful as a weapon of abolition and a very, very important way of mobilizing political passions. And in this country, you know, so many of you will know that Olaudio Equiano's a magnificent book, and then there are many women's slave narratives and so forth. And the abolitionists asked the slaves to, you know, to describe their sufferings, and this was used. So there, in both cases, I'm not at all saying that that's not a good idea. I'm not attacking these modes, and certainly not the abolitionists' extremely successful use of the subjective narrative. But I do think that it has got out of, I mean, that, and many lawyers agree with this, that the traumatized refugee who's been through an awful lot of terrible things is required to tell this story again and again and again. And never to diverge, never to introduce. You can't suddenly say, actually, I don't think there were three rapists, I think there were four. If you say that, you know, because they're trying to sift people, they're trying to get them out, they're trying to discredit them. So how come you didn't notice there was a fourth rapist before? You know? So this kind of thing is, and I think it's a really appalling use. I mean, I think that it really shouldn't go on. And the reason is I know there's no other method, or perhaps they haven't come up with one, and it's actually enshrined in the UN treaty that you have this right. you know, to asylum if she had been traumatized. So people have to speak their trauma narrative. But it seems to me that it's denying the creative, the absolutely intrinsic natural creative capacity of human beings, which is to invent, fabricate, dream, joke. You know, the other thing that you can't do is ever make a joke in the hearing of anybody in power. Because if you ever said anything that was satirical about anything that you've been through, you would be deemed to be far too strong a survivor, and also to be irreverent and so forth. So one of the great resources of human beings, which is humour, is also it's also denied. So I suppose the idea was, and it's been quite picked up by people, so it seems to have touched some kind of a chord. The idea was to try and create a space that would be a physical space within a camp or detention centre or centre of welcome or whatever they call them, that would actually give people a right to fantasise, that they would be in a space where their speech would not be considered deemed to be the truthful narrative of their subjective selves, but would be their capacity to express themselves in relation to their cultures, and indeed to tell the story, if they remember it, of the plot of a film that they've once seen, just as a form of entertainment, because I believe strongly, though it's not at all fashionable to say this, but I believe very strongly that actually escapism is a completely wonderful thing. I mean, sort of, I feel that when if I can sink into a book or sink into an exhibition, sink into a piece of music, and get out of the horrible headlines of the world, I actually find great solace in that. And that doesn't mean that it has to be a very sweet, you know, frisking lambs in a beautiful spring meadow. It can be the Iliad. It can be the Raft of the Medusa. It can be something extraordinarily powerful and shocking. But somehow, if you're able to make that move, if you're able to do that thing of creating the other world through this creative capacity that we fortunately have, it can be another place to be, and it can just lift you. And I was just reading, I was telling Omar that today I was reading Seferis's journal of the war years. Seferis, a Greek poet who was actually worked in the diplomatic and civil service for Greece, and when Greece fell to the Nazis and to the fascists, to the Italian fascists, for a period of the war, he had to flee. And so this diary that he keeps, he was a refugee during the Second World War. Twice he was thrown out with absolutely nothing. He had to strap his possessions on his back. His wife was collapsing next to him. And, you know, so it's quite a fascinating diary to read. And of course, he doesn't know that he's going to be a very world-famous writer and win the Nobel Prize. He, at that point, is a reduced, you know, an individual kind of, you know, on his uppers. And hungry, thirsty, in danger, and so forth. And but one of the things that is very clear in his in the diary is that he finds solace in the things that he remembers from home. So he being an educated person, he had a fortunate education, he knows a lot of the ancient Greek tragedies by heart. So he sort of, you know, he remembers lines of the chorus mourning the deaths of victims in the Trojan War from Aeschylus and from Euripides. And that is the same thing that happens in Primo Levi's prison camp diary, that literature, that the memory of literature and the memory of poetry brings him into another world that actually lifts the horrors of Auschwitz for him. So it seems to me that that was, you know, something we might try to do. And so we've had so far two workshops. The Oxford one was more literary, because it was mostly writers talking about, you know, what writing could do. But the one in Palermo, we actually worked with teachers and mentors and psychiatrists who work with the refugee community. And we weren't sure how many refugees would be able to come. But in the end, about 50 came, which actually took us a bit by surprise. We weren't quite prepared. And we had no language in common.
They were minors.
They were all minors, which is because the adults aren't allowed to, you can't get to the adults, not unless you have permission to go into the camps. And that's quite difficult to get. And We haven't got to that stage yet. I hope we get to that, but at the moment, you can go into unofficial camps quite easily, but and you can go and visit, but to get a group of people and work with them, you'd have to get passes, and we would have had to be screened, you see, which in England, that would have been necessary, but we didn't have to be screened. I mean, some you may disapprove of that, but we didn't. So, and so they were, but they weren't very minor. I mean, they were, you know, 18 and under, but there were no children, no babies, I mean, no little ones. So we had to muddle along, and the idea was that we would put ourselves in linguistically in the same position as the refugees themselves, because we wouldn't have an interpreter. So they have to express themselves in the new countries they arrive in, regardless. I mean, and we were trying to express ourselves to them also. So we had, and it was actually a game, you know, it was quite fun. And it was part of the process, was trying to make ourselves understood to each other.
Mm.
We had, many of them were from Francophone Africa, so there was quite a bit of French used as the bridge language. And Arabic. We had four, or perhaps five Arabic speakers with us, so there was a bit of Arabic was able to be translated too. But it was very, I mean, what was good was, you know, they'd all come off the boats within the last month.
Mm-hmm.
And actually, I mean, they had been given new clothes and things, so they looked quite, they looked sort of all right. They looked a bit battered, but they looked, you know, they weren't in rags. But they laughed, you know, they really did, and the games were kind of quite successful. I mean, it did create a kind of. I could tell you a bit more if you're interested in some methods that people devised to use, but there were a lot of kind of things taken from theatre methods, because we had quite a lot of theatrical people with us.
Well, I'm interested in the notion of the story or whatever form of narration as a potential shelter,
mm.
or, you know, imaginary shelter, as you said. How do you imagine that functioning in terms of a performance, or in terms of, you know, in actual terms?
It's very difficult to remember a story, in fact. I mean, it's as we all know, you know, you get told a funny story, or you get told a joke, and then you're trying to tell it to your friend when you come back home and you can't remember it. You've lost the last line. So it's something vital has dropped out of the plot. So there's a sense in which it's a little bit like sort of being a psychotherapist, and you have to remember how you're relating to people in order to be able to report it to your psychotherapist, otherwise you forget. So I think that it's a slightly knack of... So, I mean, what happens at the moment is that people are not given the space to do it, on the whole, not even when they're free, when they're not in a refugee camp. But they're also not really given the kind of right to do it. I mean, when you say it's dying out in Marrakesh, in the Jemaah of Fna, and has to be relearned, I'm not surprised, really. I think it is something that needs to be given space. And I think the web has actually helped this a lot, because the web is acoustic, because it's sound.
Mm.
So I'm actually, in this sense, I think the web is an ideal space for the development and memory of narrative. So, for example, these fables, which I've read many, many times in my life in different forms, I can't remember them, because I haven't trained myself to do that. I really haven't. So I think that you can...
I remember you were telling me Marina's... one of her latest books is Stranger Magic. What's the subtitle?
Charmed States and the Arabian Nights.
Charmed States and the Arabian Nights. And it's a book that kind of traces the lives of the afterlives of the Arabian Nights in Europe after the first translation by Galland in 1704. And in fact, the different scholarly chapters are... there are chapters that come in between the scholarly chapters, and which are retellings, summed up retellings of some of the stories. I think there are 12 or 15 of them. There are many of them.
Mm-hmm.
And when I asked Marina why is that, the book is fat enough as it is, she said, "But you know what happened is that I couldn't make myself remember all of these stories. So for the most essential of them, I had to you know, go over the plot many times, sum them up, and then, in fact, decided to include them in the book because it would be helpful for anybody reading the book.
Well, I think that, I mean, that the Arabian Nights is a book that almost all of us think we know. And I certainly thought I knew it before I started writing about it. And then when I read it, I realized I didn't know it at all. I mean, that it's 232 stories at a sort of rough count, because there are so many embedded stories, it's actually quite difficult to know how many there are, because many are one inside the other. But at the very least, it's about 230. And most of us know about six. Sinbad, Banu,
and not very well,
and also not actually as they're written down in that book, but that's a particular edition, recension, and so forth, and it's now established because of print, because it went into print in translation in 1704. But before that, it was exactly as Katia points out here. It was a fluid set of whatever you want to call it, motifs, memes, you know, clusters, that was like the closest analogy is a tune.
A tune.
So, you know, I could sing two bars of Green Sleeves, and you will know it. And you will pick it up if it's in a symphony orchestra, or if it's played on a penny whistle, or if it's, you know, or sung a cappella or whatever. I mean, Green Sleeves, that particular pattern, is in the DNA, is the DNA of Green Sleeves, and whatever form it takes. And that's very, very similar to, you know, Sinbad or Ali Baba or Peri Banu, or, you know, the actual essential sort of structure of Cinderella. They have a kind of, so, I mean, that's just one way of looking at it. People have tried to be more scientific about it, and I don't totally like that school. You know, there's the sort of structuralist, Russian structuralist school, which sort of says that you can give a number to a story, and I think it's much more fluid than that, actually. But that's why I think it's more like a tune. So so where were we? Sorry. Oh yes, with the Arabian Nights. That's right. So with the Arabian Nights, but one of the reasons also, and it relates to your work, and that is that the Arabian Nights exists in translations. So when I started quoting, as I was writing the book, and I would quote a scene, I had to choose which translation. And the translations have very particular character, and they belong to the period in which they were written. So if you use the 19th century, if you use the 17th century, the early 18th century translation, which is rather 17th century in style, very Clouseau, but then it would have to be translated to English. If you use the late, if you use Richard Burton, you're in a sort of world of, you know, salacious Orientalism and kind of mad, mad exaggeration. So, you know, I began to think, like, I can't, because it's, they're too particular, these translations, so I'm going to just make my own version, which isn't a translation, it's just as if I was standing up in the Gemma Elfna trying to remember the story. Yeah. Yes, so I did in that sense train myself to remember, but it's not, I mean, I'm probably not very gifted at it, but I think young people are much more so. And also, the other thing which we haven't said, sorry, which is a really, really important aspect of this idea of storytelling, is that it's a communal activity, and it's about relating to your history, your past, your context, your whole milieu, and things like that. So it's got a very bonding and very community-making, even the sort of cynicism of these stories, this kind of world-weary comic cynicism, which is so extraordinarily deep and wise, and knows so much about human nature. You know, that's a sort of communal knowledge that people can share with one another. That's not the same as reading privately a kind of love story. This is much more about, let's look at the rules that govern the world. You know, let's look at how the lion treats his mates.
The reason why we got here is I was asking you about how the performance of the story is Shelter, and you started by saying it's hard to remember a story.
Yes, well, the idea of the project is that everybody comes with memories and cultural baggage, but they don't always get asked to remember it or to reproduce it, because in the process, the demands of assimilation and all the terrible exactions of their situation as they try to survive actually sets that, because it's not considered important. It's considered important enough that they should learn, so there are schools in the camps for young people. But the schools are all to do with literacy and numeracy and it's just not given value. And we can see why it's not given value. It was considered a luxury. I mean, here it's considered a luxury too, but we have it as a luxury. But on the whole, the government thinks it's a luxury. They've just abolished history of art because they don't think it's A-level, because they don't think it's sort of sufficiently commercial in school, I suppose. I don't know what their thinking is, but so, you know, we are I mean, it's all of a piece that, you know, if you've got all these pressures on refugees, that life of the mind for them is not considered to be an essential right. And I think the life of the mind is one of the first rights. And in fact, most people depriving people of rights take that away deliberately. I mean, prisons deny people the right to be, I mean, not here, fortunately, but there was an attempt, if you remember, a few years ago to prevent prisoners having books, even in England.
Mm. What's the link you're making between, I don't know, something like memory and something like imagination? That is to say, there are the stories that you've learned in childhood or that you've memorized rightly or wrongly or badly or whatever, and the a life of the imagination that would be making up stories. I'm remembering something that I think maybe Kilito tells in one of his books. Abdel Fattah Kilito is a Moroccan writer and scholar. I can't remember who is the historical character, but this young would-be poet goes to a mentor and says, "I want to be a poet." This is in, you know, medieval Arabic times. And the mentor says, "Well, you have to go learn these 1,000 lines of verse and then come back, recite them to me." So he goes, takes a while, comes back, recites the 1,000 lines of verse. And then he says, "Now you have to go forget them and come back, and then you will be a poet."
Yes, well, Kilito has some wonderful stories. He wrote this one himself, the one about the she-camel who gets orphaned. And so this baby she-camel gets orphaned, and she wanders in the desert trying to find a family to adopt her. And eventually a family take her in, and then she wanders off with them, and something similar happens, and the she-camel, now a little bit older, wanders off into another group of camels and crosses another desert. And Kilito, he writes it much more beautifully, like this real fable. And he says at the end, one day or other the orphan will be taken in by persons unknown who will adopt her, and she'll spend the rest of her days among them. Isn't it the fate of an ode? So he's talking about poetry here, to wander, to be a stranger everywhere. And this was something known to the Arab poet of the desert. But he thought that his odes would never be read in anything other than Arabic. He was far from grasping that his she-camels, centuries later, would have reached towns of which he had not the slightest idea: Berlin, Paris, London, New York. Translated, interpreted, accompanied by commentaries, they now speak in foreign tongues. With time, they'll doubtless forget the idiom of their original. So that seems to me, he's writing about poetic forms, but I think it's not only true of poetic forms, very true of songs, and of course it's also true of these patterns that is what you call a story. But it doesn't have to be a conventional story that I'm talking about. It can be a kind of, you know, a little memoir. It can be, as I said, a joke. Mm-hmm. And I think it's actually interesting that Bob Dylan was just given the Nobel, because this is all part of that. I mean, this is a sort of zeitgeist feeling that actually someone who's, you know, when I was in France when he got it, and one of the papers published a lot of the lyrics in two languages, and I've actually never read Dylan's lyrics on the page, and they're really hard to understand. You know, Yeah, I mean, if you were given it in an exam and asked to parse it, or sort of, it would be really hard to interpret. But you see, it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter at all. Because actually, the pleasure of patterned words is not only dependent on logical sense. There's a lot of other things going on, which is why we go back to the idea of the tune. I mean, this dynamo is, of course, you have a marvellous inventory of tunes. But it is also that there's a pleasure in. We don't have to be comprehending and lucid all the time. Mm-hmm. I used to love reading poetry. When I completed and I was under a word of it. I mean, when I first read The Wasteland, I was just blown away at school, I remember. I mean, it was. And I think that Dylan writes very much like the surrealist, sort of, André Breton or someone. Very, you know, just on some kind of dream pilot. Yeah. So I think that it can be that kind of a pleasure. And in a way, that where we got to in the project was much more like that, because we were at a level, linguistic level, of we were just improvising. You know, one game we played was we had a box, and we just put words in different languages in the box, asking for different things. So each person had a turn of specifying something. So the first person said, oh, you know, something that is too big for you to carry. And the next person said, something that gets into your shoe, but it's not a stone that causes a pain, that you can't put your shoe on. So then we had these things in the box in different languages, and then we took them out in order. I mean, not in order. We took them out at random and tried to make stories connecting them. And this caused a lot of laughter and fun. You know, we had a blue scorpion as the hero of the story, because the colour that had been put in, the scorpion was the thing in the shoe. And so forth. So it was just a creative writing game, but it created a circle. It took your mind off, you know, your circumstances for a moment. So that was the kind of thing. And so it wasn't that these were, you know, well-shaped fables of proverbial wisdom or remembered from eternity or Homer or anything like that, or even the Arabian Nights. But it was that pattern making, games playing quality. And actually, I'm sorry, one of the influences on this, very strong influence on this, is the whole Black Mountain School. Mm. And the whole idea of the practical intelligence, I'm looking at Richard, the whole idea that you think through your hands, you know, Homo faber, we are the craft species, that we think with our physical haptic intelligence. And we make things like that. So, and words are the symbolic representation of what that intelligence can bring to your immediate experience.
Since we were speaking about Kirito, I'm thinking of something else that's perhaps more of a, I don't know how to qualify it, but I'll just say what it is. But I'm thinking of the question, when you said you're in a camp, you're in this situation, the place that doesn't belong, there's different jurisdictions, and you need to find a bridge, you need to find a bridge to the outside in a way. And that in the realm of stories or literature can happen through translation, for instance. But I'm wondering how often that is possible to make the bridge happen. And in terms of Kilito's writings, I'm thinking of the beginning of that book we were looking at in the bookstore. He has a book that was translated, in Arabic it's called Len Tatakallama Lughati, and it was translated as Thou Shalt Not Speak My Language. And I'm thinking about it because I'm thinking of the question of inaudibility, you know, how there's certain stories are not audible or not maybe bridgeable, perhaps. And he, in the book, he's saying, so he's a specialist of medieval Arabic culture, literature. And he says, well, I'm invited to Strasbourg in France to talk about the maqamat, which is a literary genre from 9th and 10th century, you know, Iraq. How is it translated in English, the maqamat?
The sessions,
sessions, or
it's a very, very good word for. I was thinking that we should just steal it, and just call storytelling session. Because storytelling has a fixed sound in English. Mm-hmm. It sounds sort of, and also a little bit childlike too. And but this, the sessions, the exchanges, the conversations.
Either sessions or stations, because it's different moments. Yes. There's different stages, and the main character kind of transforms and changes from story to story, and it's only at the end of the narration of each story that people realize, oh, but of course that was Abul Fath, you know, it's always the same person, but he changes aspect every time. So it's kind of a changing identity. In any case, he is asked to go speak about this, and he's wondering, how do I present this literary genre, this 10th century author? And this is all in kind of rhymed prose. I mean, there's all kinds of determinations to this. To a European audience that doesn't know anything about it, what's my point of entry? How? So he's looking for some kind of European literary genre that might approach it. So he's thinking, oh, maybe the Spanish picaresque novel. And he's like, but that's not it at all. And he can't find a genre that approaches it. And then he thinks, maybe I'll work chronologically. What were they writing in Europe in the 10th century? He's like, well, nothing. He finds, you know, one obscure author in an encyclopedia, but in fact nobody's ever heard of that obscure author, so it wouldn't help. And so then he's asking himself this question. So this is kind of a homeless genre in a way, if you're going to introduce it to Europe, because there's no point of comparison. Or no point of translation, no point of entry. And he's wondering more generally about, you know, continents of knowledge or continents of literature in Arabic that have not found an equivalent in Europe and therefore have not found their way into an audience at all. And that the Arabic writers, and this is Arabic, you know, Arabic is not a minor language. Think about, you know, much more minor languages and cultures. But he's, you know, listing all these Arabic authors. He says, okay, people are interested in, say, Al-Ma'arri because, and the Epistle of Forgiveness of Al-Ma'arri, because it is similar to Dante's Commedia, even though Dante's Commedia was 4 centuries later. People get interested in, Ghazali, because in certain places it's similar to Schopenhauer, even though it was 7 centuries before Schopenhauer. And so there's this kind of, something has value, something of, you know, Arabic writing or literature has value because it can be compared or it can be read in the same breath as something canonical in Europe. Therefore, it is translatable, it is receivable, it is audible
He makes the point that that's one of the reasons that we're so woefully ignorant, is that there has that literary criticism and literary categories had no kind of space for understanding what was actually going on. But I think it's changing, because actually I think a lot of the forms that are now fashionable, like travel, memoir, reflections, sort of table talk kind of things that are now the essayistic modes, mixed prose and poetry, that kind of thing. All these are new, are very strongly returning. So I'm actually, you know, rather hoping that it will mean that there's more grasp of the great.
Europe is finally catching up.
Yes, but actually, no, it's 5 to 8. We should probably.
Sorry. Yeah. Yes. We should maybe ask questions. Converse with
you. Yes.
With you.
Questions is really.
If you want, I mean, you don't have to want to converse with us.
Is there any nights the same, the 1,001 nights?
Yes.
But two names.
That's a very interesting question.
Yeah, but I've been thinking, is it the same one? Or?
Yes.
Yeah, in Arabic it's called Alf Layla wa Layla, the 1,001 nights.
Yeah.
In English it has generally been called the Arabian Nights in this Orientalist fashion.
It was called the Arabian Nights Entertainments when it was first translated into English. And the Arabian Nights is the title of the story.
You have 1,001 nights.
Sorry?
Some of books they call them 1,000.
Yes, yes. And actually, some of the early, and even now, some of the translations have both titles on them. The Penguin, the most recent English translation, is actually called, I think, the Arabian, Robert Irwin's edited version, translated by Lyons, is called the Arabian Nights or the 1001 Nights. I mean, they put both titles.
Sorry about that confusion.
No, just like, you know, because some of the 1001 Nights, not all of Arabian, some of the stories.
Oh no, no, of course. But when we say the Arabian Nights, it's just because that's the title under which they were translated initially in English. It doesn't mean that they're Arabic or Arab or anything. Of course, like all stories, they came from. I mean, the manuscripts come from different periods of time, so we know that some of them came from. Were translated probably from Persian. Some of them are from, you know, in Arab later, in Arabic from, you know, Baghdad, and there were others more from the Egypt. So they have different provenances. And actually one interesting point, which I think there are what are called orphan tales in the 1001 Nights, and they're kind of some of the more better known ones. Ali Baba or Aladdin, which, you know, in the first translator of the Arabian Nights in Europe, which was Galland, so the French translation was a French translation, these very now iconic tales, he never produced an original Arabic manuscript for them. So, you know, scholars tend to think that possibly he invented those tales. Maybe.
Well, there's Paolo Horta has just written a book which is going to come out, I think, soon, on the Maronite Christian Arab source, who was a storyteller in Paris. It was a tale of authorial rivalry. It's actually quite interesting, because when the first translation of Alf Lela wa Lela came out in French, a Persianist called Petit de la Croix wrote a book called 1001 Days, in which he used a lot of material that he'd found from different sources. He claimed it was Persian, but actually a lot of it was Turkish. Anyway, he found a whole collection of incredible stories, including Turandot. This is the source, the European source for the opera Turandot, which most of you will know. So anyway, Petit de la Croix brought this out, and it was the same publisher as Antoine Galland. So if any of you are writers in this room, you will know that when your publisher betrays you by publishing a rival and making a huge splash with the rival, you're pretty cross. So Galland rushed off to his publisher and said, "Well, what the hell are you doing?" And they said, "Well, you're very slow. You know, the public has got a huge appetite for this. So
Nothing has changed.
You'll be much too slow." And Galland had taken time off from publishing translations of the Nights to do a translation of the Quran, which is actually missing. We haven't got it. But so Galland said immediately, "Oh no! I'll drop the Quran and I'll do another collection." So he then found, through his contacts in Paris, he found this storyteller, and took notes from him. And he's the source for Ali Baba, Aladdin, and some of the others
right.
that are very well known. The Ebony Horse as well.
But it was always an oral source.
But he was an oral, and we have the notes. We have Galland's notes. On these stories, which he then wrote up later. But what Paolo Horta has found is Hanad Diab, who's called Hanad Diab, this Syrian Christian, Hanad Diab's own autobiographical memoir.
Oh.
So he's done a book in which he claims that Hanad Diab is really the author of Aladdin, etc., these very famous stories. But actually, I think that
aren't the Arabic versions that we have of them in the book of the 1001 Nights, you know, maybe back translations from the French and
that was done later, yes, by someone called Saba, George Saba. But it was a forgery as such. But actually, in this area, I didn't. You know, there are lots of literary scholars, including Paolo Horta, who's now claiming that Hanad Diab is really the author. So there are lots of literary scholars who want to create these very precise genealogies and original authors and so forth. But I actually think the stream of stories, the sea of stories, is not a place of original authorship. Mm-hmm. It's a place of original performances. So that, exactly going back to the tune metaphor, you know, it's Jacqueline Dupré playing this thing in one instance. You know, one wonderful writer comes along, and that's Jacqueline Dupré playing the piece. But then, you know, another writer comes along and does it very banally. But if it's your daughter, you like it. It's fantastic. You know, she's doing really well when she plays it. And that's true, you know. It's not, you don't have to be brilliant at everything. I mean, I really believe in, I think we've set far too much store by original authorship and far too much store by brilliant performance, actually. I think good enough. I said to about this project, people said, oh, but it's all so ragged and it's, you know, it's not, we're not producing beautiful stories. I said they're good enough, you know, on the same lines as Winnicott's good enough mothering. Good enough storytelling is very good enough.
More questions?
Queen telling you stories another night, another night, another night. It sort of relies on creativity. So if she doesn't think of another story, she will not survive another day. And I wonder how that ties to your work on trauma and so on.
Yes, that's right. And actually, one of the poems that sort of initially inspired me is Mahmoud Darwish's famous poem, which goes, "We travel like other people." And says, we live in the country of words. And we go on in the country of words. And so this, and I think, yes, Shahrazad is spinning a country of words for her survival and the survival of other people, women, in the stories. But it is a parable of the art of storytelling as a strategy, and not only of survival, but also of transformation of evil and wicked designs, evil and wicked policies. I mean, it is, you know, it is unfortunately, disappointingly, the case that wherever you look in the past, nothing has changed. I mean, the tyrants thrive, the injustices continue, the poor are ground into the dust, and so forth. I mean, it just doesn't seem to be any let up in this. But nevertheless, literature goes on trying. It really does.
Speaking of the country of words, I mean, the, you know, in Arabic, a line of verse is bayt shari, is bayt is a home or house.
Yes, yes. Mm.
And in Italian, stanza, of course, is a
yes,
stanza,
yes,
is a room.
Yes. Yes.
Elaborate a bit more on memory, because I was really interested when you said, you know, it's a sort of a survival and it creates a place of solace. Because a lot of, in like Syria and other places in the Middle East now, a lot of the buildings are being destroyed. And they're like more than just buildings, they're like containers of memories and people's culture.
In fact, I think that piece of Katia's, it's downstairs.
Yes,
the Algerian novel,
mm-hmm.
Which is about this postcard stand, and all these photographs that are of the former politicians and former places, the way the city used to look. And there's a critique, a sort of voiceover critique, saying that why should we allow this Orientalist gaze of the colonial powers in the past, all the tyrants who've been, in power in Algeria. Why should we let them sort of own our story? And I think, you know, that's a very profound question, actually, because, and it seems to me that it's a bit sort of salient to this idea that you should not respect the material too much. You know, you can take it as a prompt, and then make it your own. It's a kind of contest. A contest of against the overwhelming, you know, hegemony of past the past way the story was told. I mean, the you know, there was this problem just recently in this country with the Rhodes statue at Oxford. I don't know if you all followed that. Cecil Rhodes was he opened the diamond mines in South Africa and was a truly vicious imperialist servant. Even the parliament at the time, which was very keen on building the British Empire, deplored some of his actions. But it's a mixed story because he gave the land for the University of Cape Town And he also gave the money for the Rhodes scholarships, which have been an extremely good source of educating people from the former empire. And so there's a statue to him in Oxford. First of all, the trouble erupted in Cape Town, a statue there. So they wanted the students there wanted it taken down, and it was taken down.
It was a movement called Rhodes Must Fall.
Yes. And then the protest moved to the Oxford statue, which was much less prominent than the Cape Town one. The Cape Town one is absolutely in the middle of the campus and looking out over the plain of Africa as if he sort of owned it, you know. Whereas in Oxford, it's just a small little statue in the High Street. It is in the High Street, but it's just a small little statue over a doorway. Anyway, the college in question, Oriel, after the protest, voted not to remove the statue. And this seemed to me to be, I mean, there was quite a big outcry, and I don't think it'll go away. But I think that was a real lack of imagination. Because what I think they should do, and it's what, in a way, Katia's piece raises the question, is that, okay, the past is there. We don't want to get rid of the past. We need to confront the past. We need to take stock of it and sort of learn from it and you know, make it. But we need to make it our own, so we don't just have roads. And what they should have done is they should have commissioned an artist now to recontextualize roads. I mean, I think they should have got, I mean, there's some marvelous work done by artists along those lines, where something is, you know, approached and reconfigured, given a kind of the historical understanding of it has deepened.
Mm-hmm. Which responds to one of the questions posed by Katia's video, which is that those postcards, those pictures, have not necessarily been seen by people in Algeria, because when the French left, they took all the archives with them. And those pictures, those images are not, one of the characters, one of the people says it, the young student says, these are not in our history books. These we are not shown these pictures. So we're learning, we're sort of, it's a way for us to reappropriate our own history, to have access to this imagery.
Exactly. Yeah.
Which is the other point of view.
I think it's even worse than if French rule produced all these images and taking them back away and not Algerian people not being able to access the history. So it's kind of in a way liberating to be able to display them in the street and kind of again recontextualize them and create different history as opposed to what's, you know.
Yes, erasure tends to be sort of a real control of people, to erase the past for them. I mean, forgetting can be merciful as well, but to have it forgetting imposed on one, I mean, your point about memory, you can choose to forget yourself, but it's very different to have erasure actually imposed.
One last question, or are we done? There is one last question.
A reflection about South Africa.
Can you speak up?
A reflection about South Africa and the apartheid regime. There is this prison in Johannesburg that used to have political prisoners. And after the apartheid, they partially destructed that prison, and they used the bricks to build the constitutional court, which to me symbolically is really nice. It's a very strong message for the future of the country. And I think it's the history of people is. They own their future and they own their history at the same time with this building.
Good, yes.
But the question of remembering and forgetting was very, I mean, post-apartheid was a very crucial question in South Africa with the Truth and Reconciliation Commission, you know, to give a place to testimony, but also not, you know, to decide to forgive, you know, or to decide to forget in a way. So this, that whole negotiation of I mean, it's happened in different ways in history, but in ancient Greece, there was that episode where, in order for amnesty to happen, you would ban anybody from speaking about the crimes. It was sort of a kind of forced amnesty. It's what was that episode? It's in Nicole Leroux talks about it
in
her work. Yeah.
No, I don't know.
So it's either you invite everybody to speak about it, you collect all the testimonies, and then we're done, or you impose a complete blackout on everything, as though you could impose this clean slate, and everybody starts anew. But it's always a dialectic of memory and forgetting and forgiving.
Mm. I mean, there was quite a lot of resistance, and there has been growing resistance to the amnesty of truth and reconciliation, because the perpetrators, they did get away with it. But at the time, it certainly, it produced the peace.
Mm-hmm. I have a question. As an architecture graduate, I want to know where architecture comes into this, because I was reading just briefly before I came that you had a workshop in the city where you brought architects and artists together.
Yes.
So I just want to know more about that.
Yes. Well, actually, we are going to do that in England now, because, we might do it in Sicily. It hasn't been planned yet, because that side of it didn't actually happen in Sicily, because we really hadn't got that far. I mean, it was really quite difficult. I mean, it was quite kind of chaotic. 50 young men, no language in common, we need to get a little bit further down the road. And the idea is actually that it will be, and I think this has sort of pretty much gelled, because Libraries Without Borders, which is an NGO, is very, very keen on this idea.
Libraries Without Borders.
Bibliothèque Sans Frontières. It's a French-based, Paris-based NGO that works in refugee camps.
They have a chapter in the US, so they have an English-speaking... Their website is also in English. If you look up Libraries Without Borders, you'll find it.
And they have a project which was designed by Philip Stark called the Ideas Box. And the Ideas Box is a series of crates that fit onto one pallet so you can transport them fairly easily. They're brightly coloured and kind of friendly-looking. Quite friendly-looking. They're hard, so they don't look that friendly. They're brightly coloured. They open up basically into a classroom. So the crates themselves become tables and chairs, and the contents of the boxes are full of... And the main thing they've got is a portable server, a wireless server that travels with the box and is vast. It has hundreds of tetrabytes capacity, and it's solar-powered. So basically you can use the web in this schoolroom. Well, the project, Stories in Transit project, is not meant to be scholastic. It's meant to be fun. But they've got infrastructure, and they're very keen that we add our idea. We can travel with them. And the idea is to make a box that is much more cheerful, much more, a box that is much more kind of playful and improvisational, that's going to have stuff in it which we have to determine with the refugees. We work with them. And that box will open into some kind of a space. That's why architects matter. So the box itself will open in some way. I mean, it could be... I mean, I think I don't like the idea, but it could be an inflatable. It could be... Do you see what I mean? Or it could be simply a perimeter, like a Bedouin tent. It could just be, poles that you put in the ground, and the carpet or the rug is woven around the poles, so you just you unfurl the fabric and you make the circle like that.
But it's the idea of recreating a circle of storytelling.
The idea is to make a demarcated space where other things can happen, where you're not under the eye of the officials. You're in a space that is like a play space, a space of free. Improvisation or whatever.
But then the inflatable would be a great idea because it's seen as a playful object.
Yes. I just worry about. I think anyway, there's going to be a workshop. The inflatable is actually my son's contribution to this. So,
so you should like it.
Yes. But one of the architects who was involved, and he said to me that he thought the most important aspect of this space, however it's made, is the threshold. Mm-hmm. So the entrance to it, which could be quite symbolic, it doesn't have to be a door.
Oh, so that's the good word for my lisière.
Yeah, it is. But that's Lehmann, you know, that's limit. That's yes. But anyway, the point is that the threshold, which would be a symbolic threshold, it just could be a curtain. Because, you know, that is different. You put up the curtain and you enter somewhere else.